Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today on Midday, history that is no longer forgotten. My first guest has written a book about three black women whose crucial role in the American civil rights movement is often minimized. Anna Malaika Tubbs has written a part biography and part homage to the revolutionary power of motherhood. She joins me to talk about the three mothers, how the mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin shaped a nation. Plus, today is the 100th anniversary of one of the darkest chapters in the American story. The award-winning children's author Carol Boston Weatherford talks about her new book, which introduces young readers to the Tulsa Race Massacre. It's called Unspeakable. That's coming up today on this Memorial Day edition of Midday after the news. Happy holiday and welcome to this Memorial Day edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we'll begin by revisiting a conversation with the author of a book about three accomplished black women, Alberta King, Louise Little, and Bertice Baldwin. It's part biography of these women and part clarion call for recognition of all black women. Anna Malaika Tubbs writes that erasure, misrecognition, and historical amnesia are, sadly, part of the formation of African-American female identity. And her book is part of her effort to erase that erasure. In exploring the revolutionary power of these women, who came of age between the two world wars, Tubbs shows how their stories inspire the struggle for survival today. Alberta King, Louise Little, and Bertice Baldwin were each accomplished in their own right and in their own way. Between them, they raised many children, three of whom grew up to be among the most significant figures in the American civil rights movement. The book is called The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Anna Malaika Tubbs joined us on Zoom in April from Los Angeles. Welcome, and thanks for your time, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So you write that these three really extraordinary women have been ignored, and they've been ignored differently. How so?
Differently in the way in which we can see that the men that were involved in these three famous sons' lives are much better known. If you're a fan of James Baldwin or Malcolm X or Martin Luther King Jr., you've probably heard of their fathers, and there's been this thesis that the fathers are the ones who influenced them. The fathers are the ones where they inherited their talents from. And when you read my book, you'll see that that's really not the case. It might partially be the truth, but we're missing a huge part of the puzzle when we leave the mothers out intentionally.
And of course, you observe, and it's absolutely true that, you know, their lives certainly were significant before motherhood, but you write about the revolutionary power of their motherhood. In what way did you find this power revolutionary and inspiring in your own life? Because as you were writing this book, you were pregnant with your son.
Yes, there's something so extremely powerful about Black motherhood. In the United States, we're the only ones in history who have been deemed the givers of non-life, the givers of property legally. And that has caused this notion that we are less than human, that our offspring is less than human. There is remnants of this bias and this belief to this day. We see that in the Black maternal health crisis, where Black women are still four times more likely to pass away in childbirth or in pregnancy complications than our white counterparts. So the revolutionary part of it is claiming our humanity, claiming that we are human, that we are worth every ounce of dignity and respect, and how we use that belief in order to advance this country forward in our actions. And Alberta, Bertice, and Louise did that, not only by teaching their children that they were going to be part of the change, but also in their own activism, in their art, in the ways that they educated their community around them.
You write that erasure, misrecognition, and historical amnesia have certainly contributed to the formation of our identity as a Black woman, but our fight against such forces with our affirmation and recognition of ourselves and each other has been much more telling? In what way? I think that's really a powerful observation. In what ways, in your own life, and do you think in the lives of Black women across the country, has that fight been, even more evocative and more telling than the struggles that these three women went through?
I think that a lot of people have focused so much on Black women as if we are some kind of conquered victim. And something that Melissa Harris Perry says in her book, Sister Citizen, is you can't look at us in this way, as if our story is only about grief, our story is only about tragedy. We also have to highlight those moments. Of course, this book says we have been erased. People have tried to forget us. It's been very intentional. It's happened over and over again. But what's more a part of our identity, what is more defining of what it means to be a Black woman, is the way in which we haven't allowed that to limit us, to define us, that we've said, we are going to fight against that. And we are going to show this country a path forward where they are able to meet us in our vision for what's possible for the future, that we can all be treated equally, that we can be treated with respect, that our children can as well. And in my own life, I've experienced erasure. We see it quite often, but especially in my own case, my partner is a public figure, was the mayor of Stockton for 4 years. And I was constantly being put in boxes where people felt that I would fit better. It wasn't, she's an intellectual herself, or she's smart, or she has her own contributions. It was, she's either the woman behind the great man, if I was spoken about at all, or it was simply a comment on what I looked like, or, what clothes I wore that day. So the erasure happens, and I think it's a universal experience for many women, but it happens on a new level when we have these intersecting identities that create more disadvantage.
Yeah, and you write about that erasure in your own life as regards your son. You say right at the beginning of the book that you gave birth to this to your son, and you've already faced others' attempts to erase your influence on his identity, and your son is an infant, right? So I mean, this happens right away. It's not like he's 18 years old and this has been going on for a while. I mean, this is
he's barely 18 months old.
yeah, and congratulations, by the way. But talk about how that has happened. How's that manifest when people are trying to already erase your influence on him?
This is a result that happens really with the gender binary, where we think, okay, boys are influenced by their fathers, and we're constantly looking for this connection between a boy's story and his father's story. And so even in this book, I'm challenging the gender binary by saying this just simply isn't true. And you can see it very clearly in the case of these three mothers. With my own son, it's been, and I think many mothers probably can relate to this, when people say things like, he's so strong, or he reaches a new milestone, he's so smart, just like his father, maybe he'll be a mayor one day like his dad, he's so strong like his dad, and I say things like, well, maybe he'll be a writer like his mother, and I am also very strong. Why are we still relating these qualities to the masculine, to the male, and why do we still seek this notion that men are of all importance, that women take this second class citizenship to the men in their lives? It just isn't true. And I think the book makes that very, very obvious. And in the three cases, the women's lives were so influential on their sons' careers, it becomes very obvious that the erasure of them was not by mistake, it was intentional. Because without knowing these women, we really didn't fully know the men, nor where their ideas came from around how you revolutionize a country.
And for the record, if people are looking for some sort of institutional credibility, you are a graduate of Stanford University and you're about to complete your doctorate from Cambridge University. So anybody who wants to mess with you on the intellectual front has got a fight on her hands or his hands. Anna Malaika Tubbs is the author of The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. The period of time in which these three women came of age was an incredibly busy, fertile time in the history of the United States. I mean, it's between the two world wars. You mention the Great Depression, the Cold War, the space race. I mean, even up to the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And the events in Black history, the formation of the NAACP, the beginning of Black sororities, the Red Summer in 1919, the Harlem Renaissance, the Great Migration, etc. the problems that Black women face today, you know, incredibly substantive and difficult, and there are barriers aplenty. But boy, the times that they lived in make their achievements, even in on a certain level, even all the more astounding, given what they had to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, and I think the book allows us to see American history and world history through the eyes of these three Black women. So we better understand these moments where we think we knew what happened, but now we know how differently each person was affected depending on their identity. And so to imagine the fears of a world war and a draft when you're a Black person, and to think about the Great Depression and how Black women were the first to be fired and the first to not be able to feed their families. And we better understand our connection to where we are today and our history and how we've arrived where we are as a nation, and the importance of not forgetting what's happened in our country in the past, but to learn from that so that we don't repeat mistakes.
And after we've read your book and your author's note, when we've heard the histories, we've heard the stories of these three women, you say that each was a member of a family that scholars and researchers have hurt time and time again with misrepresentations. So it's not just a matter of ignoring them. It's a matter of misrecognizing them and misrepresenting them. Can you tell us how that's happened and the kinds of misrepresentations that you hope this book will correct?
There are clear examples in all three of the women's lives, but I think one that really just brings the point home is Louise Little. If you've heard anything about her, this is Malcolm X's mother, it was probably that she quote unquote went crazy at some point. And so as a clear example of what was context that was missing is that Louise Little was a radical activist. She was a Marcus Garvey follower. She believed in Black independence and Black pride long before she met her husband, long before she had Malcolm X. And there were direct attacks against her and her family. Her husband was murdered. And following this, she wasn't given the life insurance money that she deserved. And then after that, a white male doctor came and diagnosed her with dementia praecox based off the fact, and this is verbatim in his note to the state, that she was imagining being discriminated against. So a white man can say about a Black immigrant woman who is an activist and who clearly understands her rights, says she's imagining being discriminated against, and this is enough to put her away in an asylum for 25 years against her will. So this is what I mean about misrepresentation. Even if you've heard a little bit about these three women, and most likely you haven't heard anything at all, but the little bit that was out there was either out of context, not well represented, or not well explained. And so the book really allows us to challenge assumptions we're making, and also to force us to push further and say, why are we telling this story? Why has this been told over and over again? And why haven't we given this woman the respect that she deserved?
And Malcolm was her fourth child, born in 1925. She was institutionalized, as you say, because of this white doctor's diagnosis when Malcolm was 14 years old. So Malcolm, you know, did grow up with her for at least 14 years, but then had that long interregnum of 25 years in which she was in this institution. She was multilingual, very well educated, was a writer for the magazine founded by Marcus Garvey. Talk about her professional career prior to becoming a mother of Malcolm and his siblings.
Yes, she was very well educated. She was born in Grenada, and her grandparents had a lot of influence on her life. They were both liberated Africans, which means that at one point they were enslaved and then they were able to gain their freedom. And because of this, they really held on to the belief of the importance of self-sufficiency and Black people not depending on their white oppressors. So they taught their children and their grandchildren how to hunt their own food and how to think about their independence. And so Louise Little is obsessed with this notion of Black independence and Black pride. And she leaves Grenada to join the Marcus Garvey movement, first in Montreal, Canada. Like you said, she was multilingual. Some people say she spoke up to five languages, others say three. Regardless, she had this power over language and words. She cared deeply about building her vocabulary. She was a fantastic writer and wrote for the Negro World newspaper. And so when she meets her husband, it's because they are both at this Marcus Garvey meeting. And in history, we've said oh, Malcolm X's father was, he was this orator. He was the activist. This is where Malcolm gets this. And this just, again, simply isn't true. She is much better educated than his father is. In all three of the cases, the women had more opportunity and privileges than their husbands did. And so they use this to help their husbands in their own journey, to help them with their orating, to help them with their own writing and their own activism and organizing. And even after her husband is murdered, Louise does her best to continue to build a life for her family. She has 8 children at this point. She's a single mother, and she's well aware of the attacks that are continuing to be waged against her. And so she speaks up against welfare workers saying that she is not able to take care of her children on her own. She says, yes, I can do this. She does whatever she needs to, but this is read as resistance to the state, and she's therefore punished for it.
Anna Malaika Tubbs is the author of The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. This is an archive edition of Midday. Because our program was recorded earlier, we can't take any new calls or comments. We'll have more of my conversation with Anna Malaika Tubbs after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to an archive edition of Midday on this Memorial Day. If you've just joined us, we're revisiting a conversation I had last month with Anna Malaika Tubbs. We're talking about her book, The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Tubbs makes the point that these remarkable women, overshadowed in history by their famous sons, have often been ignored, and that they've been ignored in different ways. In this book, Tubbs goes about the task of elevating them, chronicling their individual achievements, assessing their influence on their children, and correcting the misrepresentations that she finds in the current scholarship about them. Because our show was recorded earlier, we can't take any new calls or comments. So let's talk about Martin Luther King's mother, Alberta. Just as Malcolm X was, you know, raised in a family that was kind of, you know, just drenched in this notion of black liberation and independence from white people, the King household and the King household that Alberta grew up in as a child herself, she was born in 1903, was had a different focus, a different center, and that was the church. Talk about Alberta's life as a child before she married her husband.
Definitely. Alberta Williams was born to two parents who were the leaders of Ebenezer Baptist Church. And again, in history, this has been said that Ebenezer is Reverend Martin Luther King Sr.'s church. That, again, is not the truth. This was Alberta's family's church. Her parents are who take it from a congregation of maybe 14 people to what it still is today, this huge beacon of hope in civil rights and saying that faith cannot be faith without social justice and a commitment to the oppressed and a commitment to the poor. And so this is where Alberta forms her belief that you have to always advocate for those around you. You have to use your privileges to advance something larger than yourself. No matter how much you may gain in life, your education or resources, you can't become separate of this larger movement, but instead you're still a part of this Black community. And so her parents participate in marches, they lead boycotts. They're some of the first members of the NAACP. So although they're not using the term nonviolence, these are the same lessons that Alberta is rooted in and the same lessons that she passes on to her own children.
Tell the story of how Martin Luther King Jr., whom we know as, of course, this icon of the civil rights movement, got the name that we know him by, because he was born as Michael Jr. How did he become Martin Luther?
It's the funny one because in history, there's two different versions to this story. So the one I base in the book is based off of Reverend Martin Luther King Sr.'s autobiography. So I'll tell that one really quickly. He was born in southern part of Georgia and to plantation workers. And his father, unfortunately, had turned to alcohol as a result of all of the pain that he'd seen and witnessed. And so Michael King was much closer to his mother. He really did not want to associate much with his father, and he left and went to Atlanta. But when his father passed away, his father on his deathbed, after kind of turning to the Lord in his final days and quitting drinking and really finding peace, says to his son what he'd been saying his whole life: I actually named you Martin Luther, one after one of my brothers, one of your uncles, Martin, and another Luther after another one of my brothers. Please, as my dying wish, will you change your name to what it was supposed to be from the beginning? By this point, at the time, Michael King Sr. had already raised, or him and Albert had already brought Michael King Jr. into the world. But he decides, in order to forgive his father and kind of move forward in healing, he's going to grant this dying wish and names him and renames himself to Martin Luther. But there's another story about this that says that it happened as a result of Reverend Martin Luther King Sr. traveling in Europe and learning a little bit more about some of the patron saints and then deciding to change his name. But I went based off of what he himself said in his autobiography.
Yeah, I like that story better. It's the two brothers, Martin and Luther, rather than Martin Luther, the founder of the religion we know as Lutheranism. and the love story between Dr. King's parents, Alberta and Michael. As you mentioned, Alberta much further along in her education than Michael was when the two of them met.
Yes, she had definitely had more opportunities than he did. You know, coming from a southern city in Georgia, he really did not have the same exposure to education that she did. She was the revered daughter of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, the only surviving child of these two religious leaders. And so they're able to put so much of their effort towards her and her education. So by the time the two of them meet each other, Michael King at the time and Alberta Williams at the time, she has a college education. She's on her way to becoming a teacher herself. He is considered illiterate. He's about 6 years older than her, but he only has up to about an eighth grade education, which really wasn't all that great, especially for Black students at the time. And so he's considered illiterate. But Alberta says to him, you know, in order for us to move forward as a family, you need to become educated. Education is crucial to the movement. It's crucial to our freedom as a people. And so she helps him get into Morehouse. It's the men on her side of the family, this tradition of them going to Morehouse is actually Martin Luther King Jr.'s maternal lineage and that history. And so she asks her father to help this new loved one of hers get into Morehouse, and he does. And she tutors him through his college education. So he goes from being a man who is considered illiterate to only a few years later graduating from one of the most important institutions in American history. And it really, it's not a coincidence that it happens after he meets Alberta Williams.
And Alberta's parents kind of did a little bit to cool things off between Alberta and Michael. They even sent her to Virginia for like a year.
Yes.
They only communicate with each other via letters. So her parents weren't 100% sure about Michael as the best choice for their daughter. But that love story is beautiful because they hung tight. They hung in there, didn't they?
And I love that story so much because it also shows how important education was to Alberta's parents. They said, this is that. They didn't say, this is our daughter. She's going to go off and get married. Great. She's found a husband and she can now make a family with him. Instead, they said, she's on this educational journey and she has a path of her own. She has a beautiful career ahead of her. It's also important to note that at the time, the law stated that if you were married, you could no longer teach in schools. It was called a marriage bar that kept middle-class women from their careers if they decided to have a family. And so they were well aware that she was going to be sacrificing this career that she was building in order to start a family. And they supported her instead in thinking once again about her career before she made a final decision to get engaged and get married.
And of course, their son was no slouch when it came to academics. I mean, Martin Luther King entered college at age 15, graduated at age 14, ended up with a doctorate like you'll have next month from Boston University, met Coretta, who was a singer at the New England Conservatory of Music, and they had a wonderful love story as well. But you also, and of course, we think of Ebenezer Baptist as Martin Luther King Jr.'s church. But Alberta and her husband took over the church at a very difficult time because it was during the Depression. What were the challenges that they faced when they became, when they were running the kind of the family business at that point?
Yeah, so not only does Alberta lose both of her parents at the onset of the Great Depression, this is also when her children are extremely young, three children that they've brought into the world, and now they're the heads of Ebenezer Baptist, and so everybody's looking to them. The Black church has always been a crucial part of our ability to recover from financial stress, from attacks waged against us, and it's a nation within a nation. It's the ways in which we've found a way to organize and to meet each other's needs. And so when you're Ebenezer Baptist Church and everybody's looking to you for that hope and that organizing, a lot fell on this young couple's shoulder in the middle of also raising their very young children. But they were able to do it because they supported the church, but even more importantly, the church supported them back. So resources were shared amongst church members. Homes were found for people, food was found for people, and it's a really beautiful testament to the power of the Black church.
And the enormity of the grief and tragedy that affects this family through their through the generations. After Dr. King was murdered on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel on April 4th, 1968, a couple years later, another son lost his life in a kind of a mysterious way. Talk about what happened to the other son, A.D.
Yes, A.D. was also a civil rights leader. He was right by his brother's side. He was also a minister, very involved in the movement. And only 15 months, actually, after Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated, he takes over Ebenezer Baptist, actually, after he takes over that spot. And then 15 months later, he's found drowning in his own pool. He was known to be a great swimmer. So, of course, there are rumors as to what happened, but I don't think the answer was ever found.
And, of course, Mrs. King herself, Alberta, met a very tragic end as well. I had forgotten this, and I was, you know, reminded of it when I read your book, but I bet a lot of folks forget because the concentration is, you know, in some ways perfectly justifiably on the, you know, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., but Alberta King had a very tragic end as well.
Yes, she was also assassinated. She was shot in the back in her church while playing the organ. A man who really had just been struggling with mental health issues and hadn't received the support that he needed, which we see quite often in terms of not enough mental health therapy available for Black communities. He entered Ebenezer Baptist that day. His intention was actually to shoot Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., but he saw Alberta closer to her, and he says he decided to shoot her instead, as well as injure several others in the process.
This is an archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Anna Malaika Tubbs. We're talking about her book, The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we can't take any calls or online comments today.
Let's talk about James Baldwin's mom, Burtis. She was born on Christmas Day in 1903. Again, all three of these women born within 5 or 6 years of each other, and then all three of the famous sons also born within just a few years of each other. Tell us about Burtis's early life, and she's got even a Maryland connection.
Yes, she does. She was born in Deal Island, Maryland, very tiny town, and unfortunately was born to quite a tragic situation. Her mother passed away either in childbirth or within a couple of weeks after giving birth to Burtis. And in this tragic situation, she decides to focus on light and love, and her family, her father, her older siblings really embrace her as much as they can and just help her through not ever knowing her mother. herself. And so she becomes somebody who believes that you have to move through the darkness. You have to confront the pain, but not hold on to hatred, to find a way to find healing, to focus on love. So everybody who I was able to speak to who knew her, her children, her grandchildren, this was the thing that came up over and over and over again, the importance of love, that you must always carry love in your heart and never hatred. And she also becomes well-educated. She was a writer herself. Those who knew her said that she wrote letters that could help transform your perspective on the world and on your own situations. And even said those who were principals at James Baldwin schools or his teachers said it was very clear that she is the one who he inherited his writing from.
And you write that of the three men we're talking about here in the three families, the Baldwin family had the least money, and they had the most challenging circumstances. There was also violence in the household, mental illness as well. This has to do largely with David Baldwin, who Bertie's married a couple of years after James Baldwin was born. This is in 1929. Tell us about the relationship between Bertie and David, her husband.
Yes, it's a really unfortunate story in so many different ways, but David Baldwin was very abusive towards her, towards their children, but especially James Baldwin. It's something that if you're a fan of James Baldwin, you've probably heard about his abusive stepfather. It's something that James wrote about quite often. And he, unfortunately, what we didn't know and what his family didn't know until his kind of dying days was that he had a mental illness and that he was really dealing with how unjust it was for him as a Black man in the United States, a poor Black man who really felt that he wasn't given the opportunity to provide for his family in the way he thought he should be able to as a man. And so his complication with dealing with not being able to be the provider that he wanted to be and not being respected when he left his home and constantly dealing with violence. And he himself had witnessed lynchings in his childhood. He was also a minister, but it turned into, you know, this kind of notion in his own preaching that the white man was the devil, that they were the ones that were taking everything from him, and that God needed to help him punish the white man. And so he was also just very, very violent, not only in his preaching, but towards his family members.
And of course, Jimmy Baldwin, very, very close to his mother. You talk about the fact that there's lots of correspondence between James Baldwin and his mom. I mean, they were very tight, weren't they?
Yes, very close. And another example of how close they were, when James Baldwin passed away and he died before his mother did, in all three cases, the moms outlived their famous sons. He said one of his dying wishes was that he wanted to be buried next to his mother. So when it was her time to join him, that she would be buried next to him. She has nine children altogether, but she is buried next to her firstborn, Jimmy Baldwin, and they share a plaque that says James in one corner and Bertie in the other and Baldwin in the middle. And I feel that this is the ultimate testament to him saying, this is who you must give credit to. If you're going to come and honor me, even after my dying days, and of course he lives longer than MLK Jr. and Malcolm X, he sees his influence on the world in a way that they weren't able to. And he says, people are probably going to want to come and honor me. And in order to do that, you also will honor my mother.
And we just got a couple minutes left here, but talk then about what puts these people, these three incredible women together. What is similar between these three incredibly strong, incredibly intelligent, and well-educated, creative women? What's the through line that you see having gotten to know each of them so intimately?
Yeah, first I'll say it was important for me to really highlight their differences, because so often Black women are reduced into these categories where people try to act as if all our experiences are the same, but it's really our beautifully rich diversity and nuance that has made our community so incredibly strong. So first and foremost, I do focus a lot more on the differences in the book, but there are things that bring them together in sometimes painful ways, but other times beautiful ways. And one of the beautiful ones is that all three of them taught their children that they needed to be aware of what was happening in the world, that they couldn't ignore these attacks or ignore what was happening in terms of Jim Crow and in terms of what was going to be said about them, but that they couldn't let that define them, that this was their opportunity to change systems and change circumstances around them, not only for themselves, but for their nation. And as much as that's a lot of pressure to put on a child, they also allowed them to feel loved and see their worthiness in the ways in which they parented them and the ways in which they mothered them. They said, no matter whatever you hear outside of this home, know what you are worth and know that because of the way I've shown you my love and the way I've taught you about your worth in this world.
Anna, congratulations on this book. I really enjoyed it and really enjoyed speaking with you. And congratulations on getting your doctorate. Pretty soon, it's going to be Dr. Tubbs, and I look forward to talking to you when that's the case. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Anna Malaika Tubbs. The book is called The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Coming up, Carol Boston Weatherford is an award-winning children's author who has just published a new book called Unspeakable, The Tulsa Race Massacre. We'll talk about it after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.